Welcome to CFRI Cystic Fibrosis Community Voices, a video podcast series created by and for the cystic fibrosis community.
Hello, and welcome to CFRI's CF Community Voices, coming to you from our home studio in Palo Alto, California. I'm Sue Landgraf, Executive Director of Cystic Fibrosis Research Incorporated, CFRI, and I'm very pleased to welcome our viewers and listeners. We have a very special program ahead, but before getting started, I want to thank our generous sponsors, Vertex Pharmaceuticals, Chiesa USA, Gilead Sciences, Genentech, and Proteostasis Therapeutics. I also would like to note that no information presented in this podcast is intended for a patient's diagnosis or treatment. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. Thank you, and let's get started.
I'm going to try and pull up my slide, but in the meantime, I'm going to just thank Ray for sharing his and Rebecca's story. It was infinitely profound, the compassion, the wisdom, the images, the wit. There's no way I'm ever going to, you can leave because there's nothing I can say that will be as profound and wise as he said. So a tough act to follow for sure. I will do my best to hopefully share something that's remotely interesting on a Friday night. But tough act to follow. I don't think I have any tearjerkers in this one, so if you're kind of feeling a little spent as I am, you'll be okay. So I was asked to sort of say how I got into CF, and as I thought about it, I realized I got into CF probably on the day I was born. Not because CF was in my life until much later, but because my sister, who was 13 months older than I, was born with congenital heart defects. And so from the day I was born until the day she passed away, a little bit after I turned 12, we had spent a lot of time, or I had spent a lot more time than most children, at doctor's visits and hospitalizations, and learned a lot about the healthcare system as a sibling. And I learned as an adult that my parents were told that she probably wouldn't live much past the age of 7. And she lived till 13. And upon reflection, it was because my parents were insanely obsessive about following everything the doctor ever told them to do. My father would sleep on the couch and wake up somehow every night at 11 to give her 11 o'clock medicine. And before he left for work at 6 a.m. would make sure she got the 6 a.m. And then my mother all day would measure her blood pressure and all this to make sure that she was as healthy as possible. And so, that sort of was my life of adherence. You just took care of health because you had to. And when I was in middle school, I distinctly remember sitting in my cafeteria talking to a friend and saying, I'm going to be a psychiatrist. And I picked psychiatrist only because I didn't know what a psychologist was, because I was so fascinated with why did people do what they do, and linked that already in eighth grade somehow to healthcare. And so in an odd, strange way, probably knew in eighth grade what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. In college, I fell in love with research and the research methodology, so I chose to go to graduate school for pediatric health psychology at Case Western. And when you go to graduate school and it's your first semester, you get like the grunt work. And so my job was to transcribe interviews word for word, precisely right. And the project I was assigned was a senior fellow student had interviewed mothers of children probably age 9 to 13 of kids who had CF. And it wasn't about adherence or self-management at all, but almost every mother talked about the challenges that they were anticipating facing as their child grew older, and they knew they had to transition responsibility for self-care to their child. But the extreme angst and anxiety they felt about that idea of transitioning and giving up control and not knowing if their child would take on that responsibility or not, but how profoundly important it was for their health. And this was 1994, before many of the drugs we take now were even in play. And it just got me very interested in the idea of how do we help people take these therapies that are supposed to save their life but then consume so much of their life. And so that's sort of how I transitioned into being interested in adherence. And then I ended up at Johns Hopkins right at the time that our adult CF center was coming to fruition and being built, because half our patient population was now over the age of 18. And so this is how I entered into the world of CF. So I will start with a little bit of data. Well, first I'm going to do my disclosure. So occasionally I do some consulting on adherence initiatives and transition programs, and I wouldn't have a job if I didn't get grants. So I get lots of grants from the CF Foundation, also from NIH, and just about anybody who'll give me money so I have a job. Yeah, that's what you got to do. In all a very ethical way, of course. So again, what is adherence and why should I care? I'm going to acknowledge the elephant in the room, that we all hate the word adherence. It's an awful, terrible word. I use the word adherence because I need, in science, a numerator and a denominator. Otherwise, I can't do the statistics and I can't get the p-value, which means I can't write the paper, which means I can't get the next grant. So adherence broadly is just the extent to which what a person does day in, day out corresponds with what their healthcare provider recommended. So that should be fairly neutral, but we all know when we get into the room with a physician, it's a lot more emotional and impactful along the way. The metric that I use a lot is called a medications possession ratio. So I'm going to explain what that is, because a lot of the data you're going to see is based on this MPR. And so when you go to the pharmacy, you pick up your medicine, and there's a certain amount of days it's supposed to last you. So you either usually get 30-day supply or 90-day supply. And the next time you come pick up your medicine, it usually means you ran out, and so you pick it up. And so if a pharmacy gives you a 30-day supply and you don't come back for 90 days, we infer that perhaps you only took about a third of your medication, so you're 33% adherent. And that's how we come up with that ratio. So it's a fairly simple metric that we try and use. So in the research we've done, we found this has all our different medications that are commonly prescribed for chronic use in CF. And it goes from azithromycin, which is pills, through all our inhaled medications, so our Dornase alpha, our saline, all our antibiotics. And what we created was something we called a composite score. And this was of whatever the person happened to be prescribed, we just averaged it. So it's very complex math. But what you'll see across the board is for every single medication, there are people who can do 100%, there are people that do 50, like 0%, but most of us hang around 50%. And usually in school, when you get a 50%, that means you failed. But I would like to pause and stop here and say 50% means we're pretty amazing in CF. Because 50% of a CF regimen means you've given up at least an hour of your life to CF every single day. And that is a lot of time, and people without chronic illnesses do not understand how much work that is. So when I say, you know, we can do glass half full, but to me this is a half full glass of, we worked really, really hard. And when people say, what do you mean I only did half? I feel like all I do is take care of my CF. The answer is yes, all you do is take care of your CF and still only do about half of what our doctors expect, because we expect a lot of folks with CF. And I work with people in other chronic illnesses, and sometimes I just want to scoff at them when they say, oh, I can't do my pills in the morning. And I want to be like, oh God, do you understand how many people would love to only do a few pills in the morning? So we're gonna, when I say adherence and we want to do better, I already know everybody's doing so much already, and that's the light in which we I think about this most of the time, is we recognize it, but we want to maximize adherence to maximize our health outcomes. And so then we took this composite score and we looked by age. And so the angst that the mothers that I, you know, was transcribing those tapes up is true. Adherence goes down as people get older. And we always worry about our teenagers, but our data is showing that even through age 30, 35, adherence keeps going down. And truthfully, that's because life gets really, really busy in your 20s. You don't have social supports. So you're not with your parent. I often say that's when you get your momectomy, because, you know, it's true, right? All the moms know. The momectomy means, you know, you don't have your supports there. And these numbers, I don't actually care what people do, except to the extent that it affects their health. So a very key part of my job is to show, does taking more medicines actually make a hoot of difference? Because if it doesn't matter, why on earth would I ask somebody to do more? And what we've shown is, in fact, those who use less of their medications, according to this pharmacy refill data, they spend more days in the hospital, they have more doctor's visits, they have more ED visits, and it costs more. Though they have higher healthcare expenses because of that. And most of us, who cares what the insurance has to pay? So here's where it really matters. Those who do have more times that in the course of a year that they are hospitalized for an exacerbation, on average, take less of their medication during that same year. It's not a guarantee. Taking your medication is no guarantee that you can avoid an IV. But if you look at this data, those who didn't have any IVs, again, adherence ranged from 0 to 100, but on average, they took about 80%. But those in my study who needed three or more courses of IVs, not a single person was over 80% adherent, and the mean was about 40. So there's some thought that if you want to avoid IVs, you take more of your medications throughout the day. And with lung function, we showed that those who were taking 80% or more had the highest lung function, and it did not decline over that year, whereas those who were taking less medication had lung function decline over the course of the year. So this led us to believe that it actually does matter to take your medicine, so perhaps we should try and help people take more of it if they can. So I'm going to transition a little bit to the Success with Research Consortium, because it sort of is the context for what's happening these days in the adherence world. And I'll tell you a little story of how this came to be. So, you know, so my story ended with I started working with the adult CF group at Johns Hopkins, and I happened to get some money from Genentech and the CF Foundation to start looking at adherence. And Genentech would occasionally come to the CF Foundation, and I only live about 45 minutes from the CF Foundation in Bethesda. And so when Genentech would come, the foundation would ask me to come and present the most recent data that I had. And every single time it showed that adherence was around 50%, and didn't matter what drug it was, even the pills, people took about 50%. And at the time, Preston Campbell was the senior director of medical affairs, and the Kalydeco drug was in phase 2 trials, and it was looking really good. And so Preston, sort of during one of the breaks, came up to me, and he's like, and if you know Preston, he's very tall, and he's a great Southern gentleman. And he said, now, Kristen, I know you can't tell me for sure. This is all hypothetical. But if we make the cure, they'll take it, right? And I said, no, they won't take it. And for this reason, and this reason, and this reason, and this reason, including the fact that you made them feel better, so they just forgot because they got busy with life. And so that a little bit put a bug in their ear that, you know, if we put all this money into building great drugs, but nobody takes them, so if you're like, if the tree falls in the woods, does anybody hear a noise? Make the big drug, but nobody takes it, what's the point of making that investment? And concurrently, I will not take full credit for this, concurrently, they were increasingly listening to the patient voice and stakeholders about just how hard and how complex the regimen was. So as they engaged in strategic planning, one of the initiatives they took on was adherence. And fortunately, that has evolved from the word adherence to partnering for sustaining daily care, with the idea that this is a partnership between the healthcare provider and the family, with the family as the driver. But as a part of that initiative, Bob Bell would always come up to me and say, well, what do we need to do? We need to do it right now. We got to put something all the clinics need something. What do I have to do? Anyway, we need a psychologist in every single clinic. And I said, we don't really know what works, but we got to do something. I said, well, we can't do something that we don't know actually works, because anything we do takes time. And the one most important thing I've learned from speaking with folks with CF is time is the most precious commodity there is. And don't waste my time. And so if I say you have to come and do a therapy session every week for the rest of your life, and it doesn't actually work, I've wasted their time and I've done harm. And you know, first rule of medicine, do no harm. So we have to figure out, does it really, really work? And so in part of their initiative, it was to develop the Success with Therapies Research Consortium. It's a horrible, terrible name, but we didn't want to put the word adherence in it, and we didn't want a cutesy name like STAR or some other horrible acronym that studies seem to often have. So we are the STRC, which means absolutely nothing. So nobody knows what we do, but they also can't hate us. So the STRC is in many states. We tried to get a geographically diverse. We have some small centers. We have some large centers. We have 9 adult care centers and 13 pediatric care centers right now. It's funded by the CF Foundation. It has a great mix of physicians and psychologists. We have a health economist. We have a pharmacist. The greatest thing ever, so I'm usually the only psychologist in a room full of MDs. And this was awesomely fun because the MDs were like, who are they? And I was like, hey, how are you? Because it was all these psychologists. And it was a lot of fun. But our mission really is to not just to improve adherence, but as you see, core value, optimize health outcomes and quality of life. So we're not just ever going to measure and say we're successful because we improved adherence. We want to say we improved quality of life. And then we have many core principles that when we are considering to taking on a project, we say, have we met these core values? First one is, are we measuring adherence appropriately? I could spend about 20 hours talking about measurement of adherence and you'd all be bored to death, but just know that most studies don't measure it very well, and it's very challenging, and usually you can't compare one study to another because they've measured everything so differently, you don't know if it's the difference between the intervention or the fact that they just measured things differently. So we want to measure everything the same way, so we're comparing apples to apples. We want to be patient-centric and empowering of the individual with CF. We do not ever want any of our interventions to be like, why aren't you doing what we told you to do? Because you know what, that doesn't work, and it's kind of mean. So we want to be patient-centric. We want to build on people's strengths and their needs. Many interventions are usually just focused on everybody gets plan A, and even if you don't need it, if it's not what's important or what's affecting your challenges, it's, oh well, that's what you get. So we want to make sure we have a great toolbox so that everybody gets what they need at the time they need it. So very much the idea of personalized medicine, not from the genetic perspective, the way our CFT, our team modulators are, but the way that behavior has to be, that people's life challenges are different, so we can't treat everybody as the same. We want them to be physical, practical, and adaptable. I can make some great interventions if I can completely control your life. Or if I had somebody show up at your house every single day to give you your medicine, it would probably work really, really well, but it would never, ever be done in real life. So we want to make sure these are things that care centers can do, and that families are willing to do and that are acceptable for them and that work for their life. And most importantly, we want to leverage our collaborations with all our key stakeholders, families and patients themselves, most importantly, but even the care teams in the community, because they're often important touch points for success. Our leadership, again, is quite diverse. I co-chair it. I run the data core because I'm a data geek. Grades Wiki, a physician at Boston Children's, runs a study management core, and then we work with Cindy George at the foundation, and she's an adult nurse practitioner. So we have a lot of again, diversity. This complex little model is not for you to fully understand the org chart of the consortium, but really to remind me to point out that we have a patient voice everywhere. So this is Kate Haver and Kristen Dunn. They're on our steering committee. Jill Mag just joined us last week, accepted our offer to join the committee. So Cade and Kristen are adults with CF, and Jill is a mom of, I think, a 24-year-old. So they're on the steering committee. They help us make all our decisions about governance and what we ultimately fund. All our protocol reviews have at least two stakeholders of either parents or adults with CF who review and say, yes, I think this is a good project. Every single participating site is supposed to have a patient family advisory committee where we take questions to. We often ask, one of our very first projects was to ask about how we should do compensation for our study and what's a reasonable amount of money to compensate. And the foundation was shocked. They were like, we've never asked people what we should compensate them for being in a research study. And we said, well, why not? So every single project we have is having a patient and adult voice from the very beginning. And as you'll see, every project we have includes that patient voice as well. So one of the first things before you can actually help folks is to understand what gets in the way. So many moons ago now, we did a bunch of qualitative interviews. So we asked adults not only what gets in the way, but what helps. And the top few would not surprise you. The treatment just takes way, 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 way too much time. But life gets in the way. One of the most profound statements I ever heard was, am I living to take care of my CF or taking care of my CF to live? And that, I think, is the challenge almost every day for folks, particularly as their illness becomes more severe. So social demands, work demands, school demands, general ideas of forgetting, But not feeling any better. A lot of our treatments are just designed to prevent bad things from happening, not to make you feel better in the moment. We often joke if we could just add a little nicotine to everything we gave people, or a little stimulant, everybody would take their meds, because you feel better. But if you don't feel any better, what's the point, right? Fatigue, you know, having lung problems is very exhausting, and you know, then trying to keep up with life, coming home and the thought of taking, you know, another half hour of your life before you go to bed to take care of your health, to take all these medicines, to have to clean everything up afterwards, you know, just straight up fatigue gets in the way. Stigma and embarrassment come out a lot, particularly in teens and young 20s, not necessarily with their good friends. But the most interesting thing I heard from 20-year-olds, you know, like my roommate, I don't care about doing it for my roommate, I don't care about doing it for my boyfriend, but my roommate's friends come over, and I just don't want to deal with explaining this. I don't want to just get into it, so maybe I'll skip. Saddest story from this was a man told us that I never once did my therapies in front of my wife. This just wasn't manly. I think they had a lot of other problems, and they got divorced, and it was probably the best thing for his health. But a very profound thing of the value of social support and being comfortable doing it in front of those you're around. Facilitators were coming to CF Clinic, and for some people it was being afraid of their PFT numbers, and for some it was the support they got from their care team. Support and reminders, you know, the importance of parents, even once they were older. You know, the number of times hearing that my fiancé sits next to me while I do my therapy. Like that was in and of itself was just emotionally profound. When there was a perceived benefit, if they felt like the medication really was happening, that was, or helping, that would make them more motivated to keep doing it despite the hardness of it. If it was easy to do, you know, if you have to compound your colistin, that is much different than doing your Cystin through your Altera device. Just making it a habit and routine, you know, folks that can say, it's just like brushing your teeth. Everybody has to brush their teeth. I have to take my medicine. You know, folks that can do that, that made it a lot easier. Distractions and rewards. You know, I sit on Facebook. That's the only time I let myself use social media is when I'm doing my therapies, so that it's this reward. And some people talked about guilt. Guilt that, you know, my parents would be upset that I didn't do it. Guilt that people before me didn't have these options. Not a lot of folks said it, but it was definitely this thought that came up. So this was a very small study with just a few adults. Then we recently, one of the goals that the foundation had for their strategic plan was to better understand the barriers that individuals with CF and their families faced, in part to understand what we needed to focus on in terms of interventions, but also then once we had our toolbox of interventions, being able to get people to the right intervention, right? If you're having finance problems, talking to the psychologist isn't going to help. But if you were depressed, I would be the right person to come to. So how do we make sure you get to the right place? And these are a lot of the same things. There are three spots I want to point out. Vacation or travel was one that had a profound effect on me. When we first started scoring these things or coding them, we did the providers first, and travel and vacation fell into daily habits and routines because providers really just saw it as, well, it's disruptive to their routine. When you read the patient and parent quotes, it was, do you know the hassle of trying to get through TSA checks with all your devices? And how often I get a pat down because I have all this stuff with me? Or the fact that I have to pay an extra baggage fee because I have a whole suitcase full of medical supplies. It was these very practical, you know, the vest doesn't fit in the overhead bin. Where do I put it on the airplane? So things that I think the care team doesn't recognize per se, but that were clearly very profound and impactful for patients and family. Energy was a code that we found common for both, but for care teams, they saw it as burnout. They've just been doing this for so long, they're just sick of doing it. It's just tiring in that sense. Whereas the patients literally talked about fatigue. I am just too tired, I want to go to bed, or I don't want to wake up in the morning and do this. So if we're both talking about lack of energy, but conceptualizing it in a different way, we're certainly going to have a communication divide on that and very different solutions. And the last two, knowledge and skills and family, you can see that the providers were much more likely to highlight those, in part because, you know, they have an experience of hundreds of patients versus their own personal experience. But providers are more likely to perceive their knowledge and skills deficits that can impede adherence versus families. And in part, that's because if you don't have the knowledge, you don't know what you don't know. So we need to make sure we create interventions that are respectful of our different perspectives, but make sure we understand them as well. So coming from this, we've then created two checklists. The first is the Behaviors Adherence Scale, which covers all treatments simultaneously, but very broad topics. So have you ever experienced access to medications problems, problems with all your prior authorizations, any those sort of broad topics? And if yes, to what extent does it interfere? Because I think there's profoundly a difference between folks who never experience a challenge, therefore it doesn't affect their behavior, and experience the challenge but are able to overcome it. And so can we make sure that we're recognizing when people can overcome the challenges that they face? And then we have treatment specifics. So for 17 different treatments that are done, and when we showed this to our co-investigators, they were like, but you forgot this one, this one, this one, this one, this one. So we said, that's gonna be in 2.0 version. But we have 17 specific ones that have very specific barriers. So I don't like the taste of this particular medicine, or it's very hard to make sure I take it with a high fat meal, or very specific to the treatment. So to test whether general barriers or specific barriers or both are the ones that are important. And again, because we don't want to put this out into the field before making sure it really works, we are currently doing what we call a validation study with 200 adolescents and 200 adults at all the STRC sites that will complete these screeners, but then complete a very long survey of all these things. So we narrowed down single questions of things that are normally measured maybe with 20 questions. We're getting their pharmacy refill data, and we're gonna see which of these items, do they matter, do they not matter, does it make sense? Because if this checklist has face validity, like clinicians say, yeah, these are the things that get in the way, but they don't actually predict anything, it's pretty useless and we won't hand it out. And so that's one of the big studies that the STRC is undertaking right now. We currently have about 30% of our sample enrolled, and we're hoping to be done by December, so that hopefully within the next 6 months to a year that we'll have some data we can start sharing. So once we figure out the challenges, how do we support adherence? Now, there, out of all the challenges we pointed out, there's probably 1,000 more that we didn't even list. So it's really hard to narrow it down of how to conceptualize. But one thing that we've talked about is we could broadly group people into three groups or proportion of how much you're in. So you can be in one or more of these groups. But there's the unwitting group where you really think you're doing the right thing, but maybe you have some knowledge or skill deficits that are getting in the way. There's erratic adherence where life is just busy and chaotic and crazy, or you're not particularly organized, and so you have a hard time following the regimen, but you really want to. And then we have what we call rationalized non-adherence, where there's a deliberate or purposeful reason that you're not doing it. And I'll give a lot of examples of that and how we try to address those. So unwitting, again, you know, I thought I was doing it all right, but wow, I didn't know I wasn't doing it right. So we did a study called Eye Care that I'll show you the results for later. But one of the big things we asked the centers to do, so the centers did the intervention and we asked them to have participants bring in all their medications and their devices and check out, do they know how to take them properly? And one center, I think it was Utah, said, we're changing the name of the study from Eye Care to Eye Opener because we have patients that put their vest on backwards. We have people who have their vest two sizes too small. A different site, I think it was Akron, said there was a family that had two kids with CF and one nebulizer. And shockingly, it was very hard to get therapies all done in one morning session. So it was really kind of eye-opening that we think we know what we're supposed to do, we think our patients know what we need to do, and sometimes there's just a disconnect because we've all assumed that for the last 5 years everybody knows what they're supposed to do, and maybe we could figure something out and make life a little easier. Now knowledge is important, but it's not enough, and this is some unpublished data from the BALANCE study, which I'll also tell you a little bit more about, but what you can see is those who took at least 80% of their medications versus those who didn't, their sort of mean knowledge, so the blue area is most people fall in that spot. That's the 25th percentile to the 75th percentile. So a big chunk of people fall in that blue spot. And you can say they overlap a lot. But what really sticks out is those who have knowledge less than 40% are exclusively in less adherent group. And so you need knowledge to be able to execute a regimen. But just because you know what to do doesn't mean you actually do it. And truthfully, I've done like these family education things before, and there's always like a patient speaker. The number of times one of them comes up to me and says, I don't do anything. I don't take my meds. And they're engaging, they're talking about, you know, they're very dynamic, and the healthcare team has no clue. They really think this is one of their perfect, you know, profound grief patients, and I get the confession that they don't really do anything. And so just because they know what to do, they look like they want to do it, doesn't necessarily mean that they are, for a variety of reasons. So how do we avoid unwitting non-adherence? Written treatment plans are great, so that it's all written out what you're supposed to do. Making sure you review device technique when your care team asks you to bring in your device and it's a pain in the neck to lug it all in. There might be a good value for that. And, you know, there are some nebulizer compressors that after years and years of use just, you know, the tubing needs to get replaced because the cats have been chewing on it. These little things, you come up and it really does impact your ability to get the care and dosing that you need in a timely manner. You know, verifying, making sure you actually understand what the instructions are. I had a screaming infant who cried his first year of his life, and the pediatrician tried to tell me something, and I was like, you need to write that down. I have no clue what you're saying, and the baby's screaming in my ear. You know, you verify, make sure you understand. And as always, ask for help. And the reason we care about treatment plans, so as part of the iCare study, we asked teenagers and parents, at your last visit, were you given a written treatment plan? And if you were given one, do you actually know where it is right now? And as you can see, teenagers didn't think they were given them, and then if they thought they were given one, they had no clue where it was. So it got to the point where about 30% of these teenagers knew where it was and had it available to them so that they could actually use it to their benefit. So 70%, no clue necessarily what to do. Parents were around 60%. So verifying instructions, this is called, when you teach physicians this, it's called tell me back or teach back. But I think it's a great thing for anybody who's in the, everybody should just always do it. It's one of my favorite things to do. I want to make sure I understand what you told me so I can make a good decision or I know what to do when I get home. It's a pretty simple thing. But it's amazing how often we misunderstand what's been told to us or we think we said something in a clear way and it's not clear in any way, shape, or form. So when, like Ray said, you know, I was part of the morning rounds, you probably clarified 1,001 things for those care providers that they were getting wrong like every day. So these are very important things. So erratic adherence. Yeah, these are, I meant to do it, I plan to do it, I went on vacation, it's a hassle, I'm too tired, I'm too busy. Those are all big challenges that we all face with many things in our life, but they are, when we're working on things that will improve our health, still lead to us not getting our treatments done. And so how do we avoid this? We identify the barriers and we problem solve. And I'll talk a bit about what that means, because I don't think everybody has the psychologist's view of that. But there's many things. You know, there's 1,001 apps now to help you remember to take your medicines and monitoring and linking to things that you enjoy, like I said, you know, doing Facebook. But problem solving. So problem solving, it's fun when you do problem solving with like teenagers and their parents when they're really angry at each other. What's the problem we have here? She's lazy. That won't help me solve the problem. You know, she doesn't want to wake up in the morning. How can we get up in the morning? Can we shift? And so then we brainstorm. Once we really define the problem, is the brainstorm that you're not a morning person, you're a night person, so instead of doing your mornings at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m., is it okay to do them at 3 p.m. and midnight while you're watching your Netflix binge? You know, are there ways we can shift things so that we don't necessarily have to do it the same way everybody else? You know, folks realize that, well, if I drive my kids to school, they could do their nebulizers in the car if I get a car adapter. And it's actually pretty impressive what teenagers can come up with as solutions if you actually ask them to be part of the solving the problem. We vote on the solution, we operationalize it, we evaluate. So this is the very formal psychology way of doing problem solving. When I talk about reminders, they actually do work if they're done the right way. I'm not a big fan of reminders on phones because your phone could be over here, your meds can be over here, and by the time you walk over here, you've forgotten what you're doing. But this is an example of a great one. These type of devices work a lot. This is the medicine itself makes the noise. And so to make the noise stop, you have to go to your medicine. And while you're standing there, you might as well take it. And it's pretty impactful. You double adherence by doing that. So to me, a lot of these solutions are natural. Don't make more work. I meet with a lot of these companies, and they have very bizarre ideas of what you should do. Well, you'll wave your medicine over your phone, and then you'll take. Why would I wave my medicine over my phone? If I forget to wave my medicine over the phone, does anything bad happen? Nope, nobody will ever use it. They use tiny little things they stick. I had one I had to glue gun it, and it was really weird. But reminders like these are awesome. Then we're going to shift to the last one because we're going to move along quick. Rationalize non-adherence. So I don't feel better. My favorite is really organized, great people. I work really hard all week, and then I give myself the weekend off as a reward, which is a great idea, except when you do the math, you're less than 80%. And if you happen to miss a day during the week because life got busy, you're now 50%. And so great concept, I love the idea, but is it getting you the outcome you actually want? And so what's the point? I'm gonna die anyway. There's fatalism, there's depression that can affect adherence. We've talked about embarrassment. And we've created some measures to look at this, and they're all pretty profoundly, when I think about the things that I've shown and the literature has shown that affects adherence, these beliefs about treatment and your confidence that you can do things are some of the most consistent and most impactful things on adherence. So importance. How important do you think it is to take your medications every day, to take your medications when you feel good, on a good day, to take your medicines on a day you feel rotten? When people say, absolutely, on a scale of 1 to 10, that's a 10, the odds that they're taking their medications are much higher than if they're like, I don't know if it matters. Maybe it does, I don't know. Or how much do you want to do it? Everybody's like, well, I don't want to do it, but I know I have to do it. When you say I have to do this every day, you're more likely to do it every day. If you're confident you can overcome challenges, you're much more likely to do it. And some of the ones I like are, we created a scale about reasons to miss it and reasons to take it. And almost everybody is pretty much saying there's reasons to take it. But folks that are more likely to have more reasons or agree with statements about missing are much more likely to miss. So if they agree, it's no big deal. Nobody would notice. They're more likely to miss. And it's the missing reasons that seem a little more impactful than taking. So the taking, I frame that as they've heard the message from the healthcare team that it's important, but then they rationalize that it's okay to miss because. And so some of those things are impactful. So what can we end up doing about it? So we try and talk about personal experiences. How does your behavior affect your health? How does how you think about your treatments affect your behavior? And are those beliefs that fit with what we know about the medication, or are they beliefs that are sort of what you've come to believe, but maybe are not quite accurate? Being part of the decision-making is key. I've definitely heard teenagers say, if I'm part of the decision, I'm much more likely to try it. But if you just tell me what to do, we're all an oppositional two-year-old deep inside, and nobody wants to be told what to do. And linking goals to personal values. As much as healthcare professionals care about what your FEV1 number is, the vast majority of people with CF, when they're not in clinic, are not really worrying about their FEV number today. They're worrying about, can I get to that school event I want to go to? Are my parents going to let me go away for college? Am I going to get that promotion at work? Am I going to be able to have a baby? Life things, the important stuff. And so if we can link taking care of health to the things that actually matter to you personally, that's going to be much more motivating than saying, well, your FEV will go up 5 points. Yay. And so one counseling approach is called motivational interviewing. And so that's one of the studies we've done, and we're in the process of writing up for publication. But it was looking at motivational interviewing, which says, if we're not doing something, maybe there's some ambivalence. Like, it's just not worth it, whatever. But how do we identify what the ambivalence is so that we can address it? And the way we did that was looking at adherence. So all the data I showed you about exacerbations and lung function, we put that data out in front of our participants, and then we gave them their adherence number and their lung function data, and then said, what do you make of this? What do you think about this data? And the feedback was amazing. It was, I never knew adherence actually mattered. Gosh, my number puts me in this number of exacerbation ranges, and that's right, I do. I have to go to the hospital 2 or 3 times a year. Are you saying maybe if I took my medicines more, I wouldn't have to go to the hospital? Comparing that to the traditional knowledge and skills and problem solving. So comparing the rational behavior non-adherence to the erratic adherence. And our results, we didn't change adherence, but we improved lung function or decline. So typically adults decline about 4% per year. And we, our group in the motivational interviewing group declined less by 2%. So cut the rate of decline in half almost just by getting folks or doing motivational interviewing. I can't even say taking adherence more because our data wasn't so good. So I mentioned eye care. That was a trial where we taught the care teams how to do problem solving. And we decided to teach the care teams how to do problem solving because our typical experience in observing care teams is, why don't you take your medicines? I forget. You should use a reminder. Set a reminder on your phone. I've addressed barriers, which doesn't work. And so we taught them problem solving, and they actually had to pick a specific barrier and go through all those steps I talked about. And the teenagers who were part of the study said, this is the first time anybody's actually listened to my opinion in my clinic visit before. They actually looked at me and talked to me. The parents said they came up with great ideas. The care team said, I learned so much more about my patients than I've ever learned before. And we actually showed that it improved or it slowed the rate of decline in lung function and BMI. So again, that's the real goal, is to always improve health. We didn't show a change in adherence in terms of medication, but you know, teenagers focused on airway clearance, exercising more, nutrition, all sorts of things that are really important, and we showed improvements. So upcoming studies. So again, measurement geek. There's all sorts of ways now that you can measure very passively that doesn't take much more work, so it's not someone has to keep a diary of what they do, but we can use devices. And the really neat thing with these devices is we can display the data in a way that could actually be useful. So instead of saying, you only take 50%, I can say, I'm looking at your pattern. It looks like mornings are really hard. What happens in the morning and how can I help you? So that instead of it being a confrontational gotcha moment, that it can be actually a problem-solving one. But before we can actually do those types of interventions, we have to make sure these devices are okay. Because like I said, I've used some really horrible devices before. And so every single time before we use a device in any one of our studies, we're doing a pilot study with patients where we say, tell me what you hate about this device. Use it for a month and tell me what you hate about it. What's wrong? How long will you tolerate ever using it? Would you ever recommend a friend to use this? Because it's really key. And so we do surveys and we do qualitative interviews to get feedback. Another study that's ongoing right now is called the Be in Charge intervention, and the project itself is called Design CF. And it's completely based off of Lori Stark and Scott Powers' work out of Cincinnati Children's, where they had shown that when you put a psychologist and a nutritionist in a room together and teach not only knowledge about how to boost calories, but also how to manage mealtime behaviors with young children aged 3 to 10, that we increase calories and we increase weight and get sustained over 2 years, which is great and awesome, except that most centers do not have a psychologist who's trained to do this. And so they developed a web platform as a proof of concept and showed that it did indeed also increase caloric intake and weight. And so the project that they have going on right now through the STRC is to create a full web platform with feedback from patients, with feedback from care providers, that will then now build this platform that can get pushed out to all the sites. And they're developing ways to help care teams and help families build this into normal processes so that, again, it's feasible and usable, all in line with the mission of the STRC. Another study we're doing is looking at telecoaching, because again, it would be great to have a psychology intervention that can help folks, but Many folks with CF live so far away from centers, and if they don't, life is just too chaotic to get there on any regular basis. So can we use telecoaching? Facebook, Skype, Zoom, all these great platforms now, can we use those to develop and deliver interventions in a way that's more feasible and reasonable for families? Again, you'll see again, here's our stakeholder feedback. Do you want it? What should be included in there? What do you think about this technology? You know, we all know it glitches. Is that glitchiness too much? Is technology not just there yet? So they're currently starting to enroll for this study, and they're going to say, after they develop what the content should be and that the technology works, they're going to do a pilot study, see if it actually works and if anybody likes it. And then we were talking about written action plans where nobody actually knew where they were. I have teenagers, they always know where their phone is. So this is an app that's commercially available but doesn't actually have any evidence behind it that it works. So we're going to try and collect that before we recommend it, where the care team puts in what the recommendation is, and you know there's reminders that can be set up, but in theory the child now always has, and the adult always has their treatment plan with them. Many families have told us, you know, it's really a pain in the neck when I go to a different healthcare provider, not my CF team, and have to list out all those meds. I want to just hand them my phone and say, this is what I take. So hopefully this will be helpful for that as well. Again, we're starting with a pilot study of, do care teams have the time and the staffing to be able to do this, this app, you know, fill in all the information, who updates it when there's changes, et cetera. And does it make a little bit of a difference? Does it change knowledge? Does it change patient perspective of these medications? And does it change adherence at all? So those are a lot of the studies that we're doing in STRC right now. You can tell there's a lot. We are trying to cover every age range. We're trying to cover a lot of different behaviors and all in a very empathic, fun way. So kind of take it away. I think, again, my focus is on adherence. I use the word adherence because I need a numerator and denominator. But it's so much more than that. This is life. And everybody struggles with doing what we're supposed to do to take care of our health. And folks with CF have 10,000 billion hours more of things that they need to do every day. So we all struggle, and we need ways to help them. First, we need to understand what the patterns are and what the challenges are. And we know that the challenges can be many. We know that they can get better and worse over time, and that from person to person they vary. So we need to have tailored, focused interventions, a big toolbox at our disposal of things that we know can help. We know we have some things that we know work. We just need to know how to get them out to the community to implement them in this era of healthcare, and nobody wants to pay for anything. That's a challenge. The STRC is really that our core focus is to help improve health and quality of life and not take up more precious time. So how do we create these things that help patients, but also are things that care teams can do and that maybe someday insurance companies will pay for? So that's what we do in a nutshell, the state of treatment adherence research in CF right now. I appreciate you all staying and listening. Like I said, not quite as exciting as Ray's, but hopefully informative. So thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Dr. Reichert. We have a couple of minutes for questions. And again, please limit yourself to one question and let them clean that mic between uses.
Hi, I don't have a question. I just want to say a breath of fresh air. Yeah, as a respiratory therapist working for the last 30 years, that was a breath of fresh air. Thank you.
It was a very good presentation. Thank you so much. My question is, how do you factor in where people are in the stage of their disease? And do the statistics show that?
So illness severity is very complex because it's a chicken and egg. There are people who want to believe you get sick because you haven't taken your medicine, but there's also people who take their medicine because they're sick. And so we don't really understand which comes first. I think it's probably a little bit of both. There's definitely folks who say, I didn't do anything until I got sicker. And then there's folks, so it's very complex. And so I don't think we really understand right now how it all factors in, but I think that's where the personalization really has to come in. So people's motivations might be different depending on whether they've experienced a loss of lung function, whether they've ever had a hospitalization before, et cetera. But I don't think we really quite know where that fits in. That is being collected as part of the barriers study where we're getting 400 individuals. So I'm hoping we'll be able to look at that a little bit. But I think it's very personalized, and that's where I think some of our interventions have to be flexible to understand that impact.
It's not a second question. It's to clarify if someone's at end stage mm-hmm. of the disease, how does adherence factor in?
It's also very complex. I think there are folks when they are waiting to get listed for transplant because they know adherence is a factor in getting listed, maybe step it up a little more. There are folks because as they get sicker, they have to stop working and they go on disability, so their ability to have access to medications change, but also their time to do treatments change. If you're sicker and you're not going out as much, you're home and so you have a little more time, but you're also sicker and feeling sicker, and so you're too tired to do your therapies. So it's hard to tell for each individual person. I think it really does vary, but I think once you're sicker, you're doing a lot, and we're asking you to do a whole lot more. We do have data that shows in CF, in contrast to almost every other illness I've ever seen, the more medications you're prescribed, the higher adherence, which is completely atypical and not what anybody would expect. And I think it is partly that confound with illness severity. The sicker you are, the more meds you are, and then the less well you feel, so you take your medicines because you feel like the medications are then helping you.
I want to echo what Kristen said earlier about this being a great talk, especially as her ex-rowdy patient. You're going to be here, right? I can find you and ask you more questions because I wrote down 20.
I won't be here the rest of the weekend, but I'll stay here as late and answer as many questions as I can.
Well, I'm falling asleep, so I'll probably find you tomorrow.
Yes.
But
okay, all right, perfect. You can hunt me down. If not, you can Google me and you'll find me and I answer my emails.
Hi, wonderful talk. I'm the nurse coordinator at a small satellite center, mm-hmm. and I am currently getting my doctorate in nursing practice, and this fits right in with what I want to do for my dissertation. So are you available for consult?
Always. Love to talk about science. And my husband's here. He'll tell you I geek out on science. That's my hobby, study design, so happy to.
Okay, great.
And congratulations on working on your doctorate. It's a Herculean task when you also try to work.
Hi, I was wondering if you had any advice. I had, as far as what a spouse can do to help mm-hmm. with compliance. I had talked to my wife. At one point, she would miss her meals and that sort of thing. So I talked her into putting reminders in her phone for breakfast, lunch, mm-hmm. dinner, and two snacks. And at the end of the week, she was very angry with me. And I didn't know if you had any advice as far as, how in that situation.
I think that was nice advice. And then it didn't work, so we changed. It's a cyclical, I hate being told what to do. My husband will tell you, I hate being told what to do. So yes, I'm an oppositional 2-year-old. If my phone yells at me to do something, I hate it. Because I've tried out a lot of those apps, the reminders, and I'm like, you're just irritating me. It's not the right time. Preparing meals so that's where the social support side comes in. Many folks said, just my spouse setting it up and cleaning it up afterwards was amazing. The sitting next to me, he loves to cook, so I eat better because he cooks. And when he goes away, I don't eat so good. So it's finding out what is helpful for that particular person, because what's helpful to someone is intrusive to someone else. And so clearly for your wife, reminders are just an alarm going, you're doing wrong. but you cooking a fabulous meal, she might be like, you're the best husband ever.
All right, thank you.
Which you are.